It also opposed the, what they called the new spirit of the age. This is like 1850. The new spirit of the age is gain wealth, forgetting all but self. Okay, ever hear that one? A little fancier, but the same thing that is drilled into everyone's head every day, today. You know, you got to gain wealth, forgetting about everybody else. Well, they were trying to drill it into people's heads in 1850, and they were resisting it because it's degrading. You know, it's not the way human beings are. It takes a long time to drive normal human sentiments out of people's heads, and they keep popping up again. And in fact, I think, at least it looks to me, the whole history of the labor movement is a struggle against the new spirit of the age.
Mr. Economist, don't preach to me about trickle-down theory. It's a fallacy, propagated callously. So we believe the deceit and keep imagination living in poverty. The national lottery is a tax on stupidity. Prosperity doesn't trickle down to most folks because the rising tide lifts the biggest boats and the sea's getting kind of rocky lately. Still, the crest don't exist without the wave underneath it. One, own the air that the rest of us breathe in. Tribute survived from colonial days. Masters demand tax from ungrateful slaves, now it's a PR game. Still works the same cash rules with the iron fist in the background. The mob knows how to lay a smack down to crush disobedience from anyone in town. And sending the goons if anyone gets out of line. That's how protection rackets work since the dawn of time. Now the state takes the same old line. Governments are just well-armed gangsters with delusions of grandeur, with law on their side as they're kicking in front doors to settle scores. Wherever natives get restless and rise up to threaten vital business interests, the death toll rises from the latest war. Yeah, we could argue all night about what it's really for. Just ask any private in the army. The only thing that trickles down is everyday brutality.
You know, think about the fact that when you go through school, you're being trained for obedience and passivity. But I think if you look back, you'll probably, at least if you're like my experience, will recognize that that happened.
I bring righteous indignation to bling bling quits. Don't need diamonds to make you shake your hips. Money don't exist. It's just figures in columns, as elusive as the cash in my bank manager's wallet. It's so common to be poor in a rich country. A $1 trillion economy is comfortable with your poverty. The market understands its wish is your command. That's called the law of supply and demand. Whenever there is profit, there is loss. Like when trade is free, the stealth is nightmare. I'm not racing for wealth and property. Just trying to live life on that line between poverty and greed. The bad news is we're not free, we're cheap. Bought off with dreams of a Beamer or a Jeep. At the head table, begging for scraps. Praying that they'll lapse and give you half a chance. And that's begging your master to set you free. As if benevolent tyranny would make poverty history. Let's ask the superstar singers. Thank God we got them to save us. Or we'd really be fucked. GNP is up, so how come I'm not richer? I don't understand economics, so what can you say? Most of us got nothing for a rainy day. Your pension is not safe with the stock market. I want my contribution back, but they spent it. Don't understand economics, but I understand this. The free market is free to those who can afford it, and very expensive to those that can't. Very, 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 very expensive. But you'll know me, I just put my lack of money where my mouth is. So if you want to come and take a ride with me, I really hope you got the money for a taxi. Oh, why do I live this way? Hey, that'll be the lack of money. Never drank Cristal or been to China Whites, but I might cane a cheap bottle of vodka on a Friday night. If anyone would like to join me, see you on College Green. That's in the hilly city in the divided kingdom. A system of feudalism means we live in serfdom. Kings got closed circuit vision to survey the fiefdom. Medieval economics, but surveillance is modern. Land hasn't been common since the Enclosures Act of 1750. The basis for a privileged economy based on the sanctity of private property. Here's good news for the many that are near the knock of opportunity. We can't eat money, so it will end the ignorant arrogance of the North Atlantic. Fashionable antics left in our wake. And if cod stocks are low, let them eat hake.
And when you watch television, let's say it's, you know, some sitcom, that's the picture of life that's presented day after day after day.
So, Mr. Economist, don't preach to me. I got personal debt right up to the knees for all the things I had to buy, like education and beliefs and aspirational magazines. Now I'm counting down the days till it's paid or I die. Let's see what comes first. There's nobody in the sky to pay for the hearse. We're not free, we're cheap. Bought off with the sedative to put us to sleep. Why not just put on a grass skirt and have done with it? If you're a native, you want money, then dance for it. Notwithstanding the standard neoliberal rhetoric, the only thing that trickles down this far is bullshit. Nations go cap in hand to the World Bank, like me at my local branch, annoying the staff, giving it. Mate, you're having a laugh, I'll pay you back, I just need one more extension on my overdraft. We wear debt round our necks like a millstone, the debt of forefathers paid by daughters and sons who dream of breaking with tradition and being the first sane generation to make a free space for living. These fantasies are beautiful, that's why we cling to them. Money can buy license, but it can't buy freedom. Do you believe them? Millionaire rappers who came just to prove you can be rich and still be a slave. Cause who pays the piper calls the tune? Who pays the piper calls the tune? There's a lot of mental slaves in recording rooms, cause who pays the piper calls the tune? And I hate work, so everyone thinks I'm lazy, but I'm thoughtful and patient. I think constantly, so time's never wasted. In case you didn't know it, I'm not rich, but I've never known real hardship, never had much money, but I'm one of the lucky ones. In the natal lottery, born unburdened by sour defeat, change doesn't trickle down to us, it rises up like dust, so stamp your feet. Change doesn't trickle down to us, it rises up like dust, so stamp your feet. Change doesn't trickle down to us, it rises up like dust, so stamp your feet. Change doesn't trickle down to us, it rises up like dust, so everybody in the house stamp your feet.
People have personal problems or something like that, but nothing that would bring them together to struggle against the new spirit of the age. I mean, what was the last time you saw a sitcom about that?
Don't let money change ya, da 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 da. Da 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 da. Don't let money change you. Da 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 da. Don't let lack of money change you. Da 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 da. Don't let money change you. Don't let money change you. Don't let money change you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
This is a video presentation by Daniel Pink, which is worth watching because the video component amplifies the already clear audio about what really motivates people.
Our motivations are unbelievably interesting. I mean, I've been working on this for a few years, and I just find the topic still so amazingly engaging and interesting. So I want to tell you about that. The science is really surprising. The science is a little bit freaky, okay? We are not as endlessly manipulable and as predictable as you would think. There's a whole set of unbelievably interesting studies. I want to give you two that call into question this idea that if you reward something, you get more of the behavior you want. If you punish something, you get less of it. So let's talk, let's go from London to the mean streets of Cambridge, Massachusetts, in the northeastern part of the United States. And let's talk about a study done at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Here's what they did. They took a whole group of students, and they gave them a set of challenges. Things like memorizing strings of digits, solving word puzzles, other kinds of spatial puzzles, even physical tasks like throwing a ball through a hoop. Okay, they gave them these challenges, and they said to incentivize their performance, they gave them three levels of rewards. Okay, so if you did pretty well, you got a small monetary reward. If you did medium well, you got a medium monetary reward. And if you did really well, if you were one of the top performers, you got a large cash prize. Okay? We've seen this movie before. This is essentially a typical motivation scheme within organizations, right? We reward the very top performers. We ignore the low performers and the other folks kind of in the middle. Okay, you get a little bit. So what happens? They do the test. They have these incentives. Here's what they found out. One, as long as the task involved only mechanical skill, bonuses worked as they would be expected. The higher the pay, the better the performance. Okay, that makes sense. But here's what happens. But once the task called for even rudimentary cognitive skill, a larger reward led to poorer performance. Now, this is strange, right? A larger reward led to poorer performance? How can that possibly be? Now, what's interesting about this is that these folks here who did this are all economists, two at MIT, one at the University of Chicago, one at Carnegie Mellon, okay, the top tier of the economics profession, and they're reaching this conclusion that seems contrary to what a lot of us learned in economics, which is that the higher the reward, the better the performance. And they're saying that once you get above rudimentary cognitive skill, it's the other way around. Which seems like this kind of, the idea that these rewards don't work that way seems vaguely left-wing and socialist, doesn't it? It's kind of this kind of weird socialist conspiracy. For those of you who have those conspiracy theories, I want to point out the notoriously left-wing socialist group that financed the research, the Federal Reserve Bank. So this is the mainstream of the mainstream coming to a conclusion that's quite surprising, seems to defy the laws of behavioral physics. So this is strange, a strange finding. So what do? They say, this is freaky. Let's go test it somewhere else. Maybe that $50 or $60 prize isn't sufficiently motivating for an MIT student, right? So let's go to a place where $50 is actually more significant relatively. Right? So let's take the experiment. We're going to go to Madurai, India, rural India, where $50, $60, whatever the number was, is actually a significant sum of money. So they replicated the experiment in India roughly as follows. Small rewards, the equivalent of 2 weeks' salary. Small performance, low performance, 2 weeks' salary. Medium performance, about a month's salary. High performance, about 2 months' salary. Okay, so those are real good incentives. Okay, so you're going to get a different result here. Well, what happened, though, was that the people offered the medium reward did no better than the people offered the small reward. But this time around, the people offered the top reward, they did worst of all. Higher incentives led to worse performance. What's interesting about this is that it actually isn't all that anomalous. This has been replicated over and over and over again by psychologists, by some extent by sociologists, and by economists, over and over and over again. For simple, straightforward tasks, those kinds of incentives, if you do this, then you get that, they're great. For tasks that are algorithmic, set of rules where you have to just follow along and get a right answer, if-then rewards, carrots and sticks, outstanding. But when the task gets more complicated, when it requires some conceptual creative thinking, those kinds of motivators demonstrably don't work. Fact, money is a motivator at work, but in a slightly strange way. If you don't pay people enough, they won't be motivated. What's curious about, there's another paradox here, which is that the best use of money as a motivator is to pay people enough to take the issue of money off the table. Pay people enough so that they're not thinking about money and they're thinking about the work. Now, once you do that, it turns out there are three factors that the science shows lead to better performance, not to mention personal satisfaction. Autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Autonomy is our desire to be self-directed, to direct our own lives. Now, in many ways, traditional notions of management run afoul of that. Management is great if you want compliance, but if you want engagement, which is what we want in the workforce today as people are doing more complicated, sophisticated things, self-direction is better. Let me give you some examples of this, of almost radical forms of self-direction in the workplace that lead to good results. Let's start with this company right here, Atlassian, an Australian company. It's a software company, and they do something really cool. Once a quarter, on a Thursday afternoon, they say to their developers, for the next 24 hours, you can work on anything you want. You can work on it the way you want. You can work on it with whomever you want. All we ask is that you show the results to the company at the end of those 24 hours in this fun kind of meeting, not a star chamber session, but this fun meeting with beer and cake and fun and other things like that. It turns out that that one day of pure, undiluted autonomy has led to a whole array of fixes for existing software, a whole array of ideas for new products that otherwise had never emerged. One day. Now, this is not an if-then incentive. This is not the sort of thing that I would have done 3 years ago before I knew this research. I would have said, you want people to be creative and innovative? Give them a freaking innovation bonus. If you do something cool, I'll give you $2,500. They're not doing this at all. They're essentially saying, you probably want to do something interesting. Let me just get out of your way. One day of autonomy produces things that had never emerged. Right, let's talk about mastery. Mastery is our urge to get better at stuff. We like to get better at stuff. This is why people play musical instruments on the weekend. You got all these people who are acting in ways that seem irrational economically. They play musical instruments on weekends. Why? It's not going to get them a mate. It's not going to make them any money. Why are they doing it? Because it's fun, because you get better at it, and that's satisfying. Go back in time a little bit. I imagine this if I went to my first economics professor, a woman named Mary Alice Shulman, and I went to her in 1983 and said, Professor Shulman, can I talk to you after class for a moment? I got this inkling. I got this idea for a business model. I just want to run it past you. Here's how it would work. You get a bunch of people around the world who are doing highly skilled work, but they're willing to do it for free and volunteer their time, 20, sometimes 30 hours a week. Okay, she's looking at you somewhat skeptically there. Oh, but I'm not done. And then what they create, they give it away rather than sell it. It's going to be huge. I mean, she truly would have thought I was insane. Okay, it seemed to fly in the face of so many things. But what do you have? You have Linux powering 1 out of 4 corporate servers in Fortune 500 companies, Apache powering more than the majority of web servers, Wikipedia. What's going on? Why are people doing this? Why are these people, many of whom are technically sophisticated, highly skilled people who have jobs? Okay? They have jobs. They're working at jobs for pay, doing sophisticated technological work. And yet, during their limited discretionary time, they do equally, if not more, technically sophisticated work, not for their employer, but for someone else for free. That's a strange economic behavior. Economists who look into it, why are they doing this? It's overwhelmingly clear. Challenge and mastery, along with making a contribution. That's it. What you see more and more is a rise of what you might call the purpose motive, is that more and more organizations want to have some kind of transcendent purpose, partly because it makes coming to work better, partly because that's the way to get better talent. And what we're seeing now is, in some ways, when the profit motive becomes unmoored from the purpose motive, bad things happen. Bad things ethically sometimes, but also bad things just like not good stuff, like crappy products, like lame services, like uninspiring places to work. That when the profit motive is paramount, or when it becomes completely unhitched from the purpose motive, it's just people don't do great things. More and more organizations are realizing this and sort of disturbing the categories between what's profit and what's purpose. And I think that actually heralds something interesting. And I think that the companies that organizations that are flourishing, whether they're profit, for profit, or somewhere in between, are animated by this purpose motive. Let me give you a couple of examples. Here's the founder of Skype. He says, our goal is to be disruptive, but in the cause of making the world a better place. Pretty good purpose. Here's Steve Jobs. I want to put a ding in the universe. All right? That's the kind of thing that might get you up in the morning and racing to go to work. So I think that that we are purpose maximizers, not only profit maximizers. I think the science shows that we care about mastery very, very deeply. And the science shows that we want to be self-directed. And I think that the big takeaway here is that if we start treating people like people and not assuming that they're simply horses, you know, slower, smaller, better-smelling horses, if we get past this kind of ideology of carrots and sticks and look at the science, I think we can actually build organizations and work lives that make us better off, but I also think they have the promise to make our world just a little bit better.
We won't be surprised to hear that I would take that last sentiment and amplify it. Rather than making the world just a little bit better, I think that treating people like people and not trying to manipulate them into doing things they don't want to do has the potential to turn this world around, to turn human influence from being one which has been largely destructive of the ecosphere into being something which is productive, of turning everyday life from many people from a drudge and something that has to be worked through into something that can be played and enjoyed and lived to the full every moment. This is, of course, nothing new to regular listeners of the show, and for those of you who don't remember it, I'm going to replay an older episode. This is from episode 183, Lynn Gehry's thoughts about working for shovels.
I am opposed to the capitalist system because it is an inherently unfair form of social organization that ensures that some people in society will be in a position of degradation, and thus it pits members of society against one another as each fights not to be one of the degraded, and therefore ensures that someone else is. Every gain a person makes must be on someone else's back by design. My mother's childhood friend, Mrs. Bauer, was a prisoner in a Nazi concentration camp. Mrs. Bauer, then a 15-year-old girl, was among 13 female prisoners who were given 12 shovels by the Nazi guards and told to dig holes. They were told that anyone not working would be executed. These prisoners, all previously ordinary, decent people, were forced to fight each other for the privilege of having a shovel and thus condemning to death one among them so that they themselves might live. I was 15 years old when I heard this story, the same age as my mother's friend had been when she had been given the choice of killing for a shovel or dying without one. I had heard stories of the Nazi atrocities all my life, but it was not the same as having someone you knew sit before you, show you the numbers on their arm, and tell you such things. The woman in front of me telling me this horrific story was a gracious middle-aged woman with two grown daughters who lived what would be considered a normal, respectable life. My family had just eaten the dinner she cooked for us. I was so horrified by what she told me that I couldn't bring myself to ask her any more questions about it. I just kept thinking, what if it were me? It could have been me. What would I have done? People have argued for centuries over whether human beings are intrinsically good or intrinsically evil. That's the wrong question. Human beings, like other animals, have basic instincts to survive and, on the whole, will respond to whatever situation they find themselves in to do what is necessary to live. What is so wrong about capitalism is that, like the concentration camp example, it puts people in a situation where, in order to survive, they must do so at someone else's expense. And there is no objective reason for things to be that way. I call that an evil system. Competition, winning and losing, may be fine in a game, but life is not a game. The person who loses a competition in life ends up hungry, homeless, or dead. Society as a whole does not benefit by creating losers. But this society likes to pretend the losers don't exist and focus its self-congratulatory propaganda on the wonderful circumstances of the lucky winners. The Nazis in our earlier example had enough shovels for the 13 prisoners. They just held them back because they were sadistic bastards. The capitalists are controlling resources in excess of what they need, which would be more than enough for everyone else. But they are holding them so they can dole them out in an extortionate transaction called the market. What I'm talking about is people who are hoarding resources in excess of what they themselves are actually using. Never mind the 20-room mansion. The owner of the 20-room mansion also owns three boarded-up buildings, say, in downtown Washington, D.C. He does not intend to live there, and he has the legal right to make sure that no one else does unless they meet his demands. And I'm not even talking about the sumptuous banquet served at the mansion. I'm talking about the food thrown in the garbage at the end of each day at each of his chain of grocery stores. I'm talking about the piles of goods in stores thrown away each year to make room for the next year's model, in order that no one may live without fighting for a shovel. Every day in America, hungry people rummage through trash bins looking for food or clothing or other usable items. They are arrested or threatened with arrest by police. I am not aware of any instance where any business or homeowner has been threatened or arrested for throwing away items that others desperately need. Of course they haven't, because they have a legal right to throw food in the garbage. But a hungry person has no legal right in this country to be able to eat. What amazes me about all those people who are very outraged about the right to life of a fetus don't seem to think that anyone actually born has any right to life, since no one can live without adequate food and shelter. I'm a white middle-class person, one of the people with many victories in the shovel war, and I'm angry because in spite of hearing Mrs. Bauer's story, I have essentially been given the same sort of choice. The Limbaugh-esque gasbags who loudly degrade the losers of America's shovel wars like to rationalize a situation by insisting that they, the winners, are somehow more deserving. But the very vehemence and volume of their protestations makes me wonder if somewhere inside they know that they're playing the commandant's game.
Lynn is covering a lot of ground here. You may be wondering, well, what are the shovels? Isn't it the case that if somebody is short of money, then that shows that they weren't good with money, they weren't economically literate enough, to use the frame that we introduced in the last episode? Certain fundamental points, such as the scarcity of money, are seldom taught on these economic literacy courses. For example, in contrast to former times, money is lent into existence. It's created as an amount that has to be repaid, plus interest ensures scarcity in the money supply, because there is no money created to give that interest back. So people are therefore either short of money themselves, or if they manage to get that money from other people, they put someone else deeper into debt. This is, of course, a topic which has been covered on the show before. If you'd like to know more about it, I encourage you to look up Wizards of Money, Episode 1, How Money is Created. Now we're going to listen to Adam Curtis from his documentary The Trap about the effects of trying to motivate people by using external targets. This was something that was carried out in the UK in the last 20 or 30 years. I heard about this when I was at university and I studied a couple of business studies courses. Originally, the idea of targets and monitoring came from manufacturing, and I don't have a problem with quality control in the manufacturing process. I like the idea, when I buy a laptop, that it's already been tested and monitored and met the required standards, and if it didn't, then it wouldn't have been sold to me. However, this approach is now applied not only in the manufacturing of objects, but across the board in public services. Everywhere from schools, to hospitals, to the police force, there's an obsession with measurable outcomes, with targets. As Alfie Kern said, there's an obsession with behavior and not with motivation. Underlying this is the fear of scarcity, fear that people may be cheating. And it's the same set of ideas which says we have to motivate children to make them good, because if we didn't, they would be bad. If this seems familiar, you may be recalling how neatly this fits into Lakoff's strict father model. And I believe, as Alfie Kohn was saying, that it is a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you assume that the world is full of liars, crooks, and thieves, who, given any opportunity, will behave badly, this has a negative effect on people's motivation, their attitude, and their behavior, and explains a lot of what is going on in the societies of the so-called rich countries, which are basically at a low-level war against one another. So here's Adam Curtis's take on the effects of using targets.
In the management of society, New Labour turned to the mathematical systems that John Major had brought in, but on a scale never seen before. They believed that people actually behaved in the way described by the simplified economic model. Performance targets and incentives would be set for everything and everyone. Even cabinet ministers would have to fulfill their performance targets or be punished.
Stephen Byers, Chief Secretary of the Treasury, 1998.
300 or so performance targets, over 150 efficiency targets. Each public service agreement will have a named minister who is responsible for delivering and achieving those targets. They may not have to resign, but they will have to explain why they haven't been able to meet their targets. If a department fails to meet those targets, then it's only right and proper that government will look seriously at their ability to deliver.
The Treasury, under Gordon Brown, created a vast mathematical system. They invented ways of giving numerical values to things that previously no one thought could be measured. Hunger in sub-Saharan Africa was to be reduced to below 48%, while world conflict was to be reduced by 6%. And all the towns and villages in Britain were to be measured for a community vibrancy index. And even the quality of life in the countryside was broken down into a series of indices, one of which measured how much birdsong there should be.
We want a barometer of the indicators of the quality of life, and they're not simply the economic ones. Half of the skylarks have gone since 1970. Now, if you want to measure the quality of the life, then one of the things is that dawn chorus. It's about indices that affect everybody in a quality of a life barometer.
The original idea behind the mathematical system was that it would liberate public servants from old forms of bureaucratic control. Once they were given the targets, they were free to achieve them any way they wanted. But almost immediately, New Labour began to discover that people were more complex and devious than the simple model allowed. Public servants began to find the most ingenious ways of hitting their targets.
James Strachan, chairman of the Audit Commission.
It's about the pressure to meet these targets. It's causing some NHS managers to game the system.
Hospital managers proved to be particularly devious. When they were set targets to cut waiting lists, they ordered consultants to do the easiest operations first, like bunions and mastectomies. Complicated ones, like cancers, were no longer prioritised. And they found other clever ways of getting people off the lists.
What happened at this hospital is truly shocking. Administrators wrote to patients asking them when they'd be on holiday. They then used that information to set the timing of the operation, knowing that the patients would be away. As a result, the patients did not get their operations, but the hospital managed to cut its waiting lists.
And when the managers were set a target to reduce waiting times in casualty, they came up with more clever strategies. A new job was invented, called the hello nurse, who did nothing to treat the patient, but simply greeting them meant they had been seen and were off the list. When the government then tried to set a target to reduce the number of patients waiting on trolleys, the managers took the wheels off the trolleys and reclassified them as beds. And they redefined the corridors as walls. And yet again, the patients were off the list. The police were also under pressure to meet their targets. One of the main ones was to reduce the rate of recorded crime. Again, inventive strategies were found. Lothian police announced the most successful crime figures in 25 years. But it was later found that they had reclassified hundreds of crimes, including assault, robbery and fire raising, as simply suspicious occurrences, which wouldn't be included in the figures.
We are passionate about meeting these targets.
Fiddling
by the management.
Altered their records.
But that's a bit odd. I mean, you're the consultant.
And started to amend some of the answers that the youngsters had given.
Trolley weights, none.
Targets, three levels of targets.
Clear targets, targets, those targets. Focus on those targets. Why are they targets? Targets.
The government tried to dismiss these reports as just a few bad examples. But report after report came out, which revealed that this inventive gaming of the system was now endemic throughout the public services. What was supposed to be a rational system was instead creating a strange world in which no one knew whether to believe the numbers or not. The government's response was to introduce even more mathematical levels of management. Complex systems of auditing were created to monitor workers and make sure they fulfilled the targets in the correct way. What had begun as a system of liberation was turning into a powerful system of control.
If I don't hit those targets, then I don't get a pay increase. It's as simple as that.
They withhold your increment?
They withhold my increment.
Not meeting the targets is really not an option.
It's such an important target that I get to keep my job this month because there's no red on the screen.
If they don't reach the targets, they're axed, and if they speak out against them, they're axed. We here have a catch-22 situation.
If you get zero-star rated, you are being watched like a hawk.
So, I think you should go.
But the numbers were also having a strange and perverse effect on New Labour's vision of a freer and more open Britain. They were, in fact, creating a more rigid and stratified society. At the heart of this was education and the league tables for schools. The tables showed parents which were the best performing schools and which were the worst ones. The government said that this would incentivise the less successful ones to compete and improve their services, and standards would then rise across the country. In fact, the very opposite happened. Rich parents moved into the areas of the best schools, which then caused house prices to spiral, keeping the poor out. And nearly all schools taught their pupils only those narrow facts they would need to answer in exams, and so would help the schools rise up the league tables. What was lost was the wider education that would help the poorer children rise up in society.
The damaging effects of targets are being more widely understood, but people continue to use them because they say, well, what else is there? How else can we control people to be sure that they're doing what they ought to be doing? This reflects the damage, which was indicated by Alfie Cohn, of treating children as little monsters who don't have the possibility of internally motivated good behaviour. To behave well, because that is how people like to behave, doesn't make sense to somebody who doesn't like to behave well. I believe that people need to reconceive what it is to be a human. If people are intrinsically motivated and they're operating out of love, it doesn't seem unlikely to them that other people could be doing that as well. I'm pleased to be able to finish tonight's show with, I think, a very encouraging presentation to a large group of financially very rich people, mainly business leaders, by a guy called Barry Schwartz, about the importance of moral values. He says that he believes that people would love to be able to do the right thing, and suggests that organizations are what's stopping them. I believe that the money system itself is one of the most powerful, perhaps the most powerful, of those structures which is stopping people expressing the love within them. Here's Barry Schwartz on moral values.
In his inaugural address, Barack Obama appealed to each of us to give our best as we try to extricate ourselves from this current financial crisis. But what did he appeal to? He did not, happily, follow in the footsteps of his predecessor and tell us to just go shopping. Nor did he tell us, trust your country, invest, invest, invest. Instead, what he told us was to put aside childish things. And he appealed to virtue. Virtue is an old-fashioned word. It seems a little out of place in a cutting-edge environment like this one. And besides, some of you might be wondering, what the hell does it mean? Let me begin with an example. This is the job description of a hospital janitor that is scrolling up on the screen. And all of the items on it are unremarkable. They're the things you would expect. Mop the floors, sweep them, empty the trash, restock the cabinets. It may be a little surprising how many things there are, but it's not surprising what they are. But the one thing I want you to notice about them is this. Even though this is a very long list, there isn't a single thing on it that involves other human beings. Not one. The janitor's job could just as well be done in a mortuary as in a hospital. And yet, when some psychologists interviewed hospital janitors to get a sense of what they thought their jobs were like, they encountered Mike, who told them about how he stopped mopping the floor because Mr. Jones was out of his bed, getting a little exercise, trying to build up his strength, walking slowly up and down the hall. And Charlene told them about how she ignored her supervisor's admonition and didn't vacuum the visitor's lounge because there were some family members who were there all day, every day, who at this moment happened to be taking a nap. And then there was Luke, who washed the floor in a comatose young man's room twice, because the man's father, who had been keeping a vigil for 6 months, didn't see Luke do it the first time, and his father was angry. And behavior like this from janitors, from technicians, from nurses, and if we're lucky every now and then, from doctors, doesn't just make people feel a little better. It actually improves the quality of patient care and enables hospitals to run well. Now, not all janitors are like this, of course. But the ones who are think that these sorts of human interactions involving kindness, care, and empathy are an essential part of the job. And yet, their job description contains not one word about other human beings. These janitors have the moral will to do right by other people. And beyond this, they have the moral skill to figure out what doing right means. Practical wisdom, Aristotle told us, is the combination of moral will and moral skill. A wise person knows when and how to make the exception to every rule, as the janitors knew when to ignore their job duties in the service of other objectives. A wise person knows how to improvise, as Luke did when he rewashed the floor. Real-world problems are often ambiguous and ill-defined, and the context is always changing. A wise person is like a jazz musician, using the notes on a page, but dancing around them, inventing combinations that are appropriate for the situation and the people at hand. A wise person knows how to use these moral skills in the service of the right aims, to serve other people, not to manipulate other people. And finally, perhaps most important, a wise person is made, not born. Wisdom depends on experience, and not just any experience. You need the time to get to know the people that you're serving. You need permission to be allowed to improvise, to try new things, occasionally to fail, and to learn from your failures. And you need to be mentored by wise teachers. When you ask the janitors who behave like the ones I described how hard it is to learn to do their jobs, they tell you that it takes lots of experience. And they don't mean it takes lots of experience to learn how to mop floors and empty trash cans. It takes lots of experience to learn how to care for people. At TED, brilliance is rampant. It's scary. The good news is that you don't need to be brilliant to be wise. The bad news is that without wisdom, brilliance isn't enough. It's as likely to get you into trouble and other people into trouble as anything else. Now, I hope that we all know this. There's a sense in which it's obvious, and yet, let me tell you a little story. It's a story about lemonade. A dad and his 11-year-old son were watching a Detroit Tigers game at the ballpark. His son asked him for some lemonade, and dad went to the concession stand to buy it. All they had was Mike's Hard Lemonade, which was 5% alcohol. Dad, being an academic, had no idea that Mike's Hard Lemonade contained alcohol, so he brought it back. And the kid was drinking it, and a security guard spotted it and called the police, who called an ambulance. They rushed to the ballpark, whisked the kid to the hospital. The emergency room ascertained that the kid had no alcohol in his blood. Whew! And they were ready to let the kid go, but not so fast. The Wayne County Child Welfare Protective Agency said no, and the child was sent to a foster home for 3 days. At that point, can the child go home? Well, a judge said, yes, but only if the dad leaves the house and checks into a motel. After 2 weeks, I'm happy to report the family was reunited, but the welfare workers and the ambulance people and the judge all said the same thing. We hate to do it, but we have to follow procedure. How do things like this happen? Scott Simon, who told this story on NPR, said, "Rules and procedures may be dumb, but they spare you from thinking. And to be fair, rules are often imposed because previous officials have been lax and they let a child go back to an abusive household. Fair enough. When things go wrong, as of course they do, we reach for two tools to try to fix them. One tool we reach for is rules. Better ones, more of them. The second tool we reach for is incentives. Better ones, more of them. What else, after all, is there? We can certainly see this in response to the current financial crisis. Regulate, 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 fix the incentives, fix the incentives, fix the incentives. The truth is that neither rules nor incentives are enough to do the job. How could you even write a rule that got the janitors to do what they did? And would you pay them a bonus for being empathic? It's preposterous on its face. And what happens is that as we turn increasingly to rules, rules and incentives may make things better in the short run, but they create a downward spiral that makes them worse in the long run. Moral skill is chipped away by an over-reliance on rules that deprives us of the opportunity to improvise and learn from our improvisations. And moral will is undermined by an incessant appeal to incentives that destroy our desire to do the right thing. And without intending it, by appealing to rules and incentives, we are engaging in a war on wisdom. Let me just give you a few examples. First, of rules and the war on moral skill. The lemonade story is one. Second, no doubt more familiar to you, is the nature of modern American education. Scripted, lockstep curricula. Here's an example from Chicago kindergarten. Reading and enjoying literature and words that begin with B, the bath. Assemble students on a rug. Give students a warning about the dangers of hot water. Say 75 items in this script to teach a 25-page picture book all over Chicago in every kindergarten class in the city. Every teacher is saying the same words in the same way on the same day. We know why these scripts are there. We don't trust the judgment of teachers enough to let them loose on their own. Scripts like these are insurance policies against disaster. And they prevent disaster. But what they assure in its place is mediocrity. Don't get me wrong, we need rules. Jazz musicians need some notes. Most of them need some notes on the page. We need more rules for the bankers, God knows. But too many rules prevent accomplished jazz musicians from improvising. And as a result, they lose their gifts. Or worse, they stop playing altogether. Now, how about incentives? They seem cleverer. If you have one reason for doing something, and I give you a second reason for doing the same thing, it seems only logical that two reasons are better than one, and you're more likely to do it. Right? Well, not always. Sometimes two reasons to do the same thing seem to compete with one another instead of complementing, and they make people less likely to do it. I'll just give you one example because time is racing. In Switzerland, back in about 15 years ago, they were trying to decide where to site nuclear waste dumps. There was going to be a national referendum, and some psychologists went around and polled citizens who were very well informed. And they said, would you be willing to have a nuclear waste dump in your community? Astonishingly, 50% of the citizens said yes. They knew it or thought it was dangerous. They thought it would reduce their property values. But it had to go somewhere, and they had responsibilities as citizens. The psychologists asked other people a slightly different question. They said, if we paid you 6 weeks' salary every year, would you be willing to have a nuclear waste dump in your community? Two reasons. It's my responsibility, and I'm getting paid. Instead of 50% saying yes, 25% said yes. What happens is that the introduction of the incentive gets us so that instead of asking, what is my responsibility? All we ask is what serves my interests. When incentives don't work, when CEOs ignore the long-term health of their companies in pursuit of short-term gains that will lead to massive bonuses, the response is always the same. Get smarter incentives. The truth is that there are no incentives you can devise that are ever going to be smart enough. Any incentive system can be subverted by bad will. We need incentives. People have to make a living. But excessive reliance on incentives demoralizes professional activity in two senses of that word. It causes people who engage in that activity to lose morale, and it causes the activity itself to lose morality. Barack Obama said before he was inaugurated, "We must ask not just is it profitable, but is it right?" And when professions are demoralized, everyone in them becomes dependent on, addicted to incentives, and they stop asking, is it right? We see this in medicine. And we certainly see it in the world of business. It is obvious that this is not the way people want to do their work. So what can we do? A few sources of hope. We ought to try to remoralize work. One way not to do it: teach more ethics courses. There is no better way to show people that you're not serious than to tie up everything you have to say about ethics into a little package with a bow and consign it to the margins as an ethics course. What to do instead? One, celebrate moral exemplars. Acknowledge when you go to law school that a little voice is whispering in your ear about Atticus Finch. No 10-year-old goes to law school to do mergers and acquisitions. People are inspired by moral heroes. But we learn that with sophistication comes the understanding that you can't acknowledge that you have moral heroes. Well, acknowledge them, be proud that you have them, celebrate them, and demand that the people who teach you acknowledge and celebrate them too. That's one thing we can do. I don't know how many of you remember this. Another moral hero, 15 years ago, Aaron Feuerstein, who was the head of Malden Mills in Massachusetts. They made Polar Tech. The factory burned down. 3,000 employees, he kept every one of them on the payroll. Why? Because it would have been a disaster for them and for the community if he had let them go. Maybe on paper our company's worth less to Wall Street, but I can tell you it's worth more. We're doing fine. Just at this TED, we heard talks from several moral heroes, two particularly inspiring to me. One was Ray Anderson, who turned a part of the evil empire into a zero footprint or almost a zero footprint business. Why? Because it was the right thing to do. And a bonus he's discovering is he's actually going to make even more money. His employees are inspired by the effort. Why? Because they're happy to be doing something that's the right thing to do. Yesterday, we heard Willie Smits talk about reforesting in Indonesia. And in many ways, this is the perfect example, because it took the will to do the right thing. And God knows it took a huge amount of technical skill. I boggled at how much he needed to know and his associates in order to plot this out. But most important to make it work, and he emphasized this, is that it took knowing the people in the communities. Unless the people you're working with are behind you, this will fail. And there isn't a formula to tell you how to get the people behind you, because different people in different communities organize their lives in different ways. So there's a lot here at TED and at other places to celebrate, and you don't have to be a mega hero. There are ordinary heroes like the janitors who are worth celebrating too. As practitioners, each and every one of us should strive to be ordinary. if not extraordinary heroes. As heads of organizations, we should strive to create environments that encourage and nurture both moral skill and moral will. Even the wisest and most well-meaning people will give up if they have to swim against the current in the organizations in which they work. If you run an organization, you should be sure that none of the jobs have job descriptions like the job description of the janitors. Because the truth is that any work you do that involves interaction with other people is moral work. And any moral work depends upon practical wisdom. And perhaps most important, as teachers, we should strive to be the ordinary heroes, the moral exemplars to the people we mentor. And there are a few things that we have to remember as teachers. One is that we are always teaching. Someone is always watching. The camera is always on. Bill Gates talked about the importance of education, and in particular the model that Kip was providing. Knowledge is power. And he talked about a lot of the wonderful things that Kip is doing to take inner city kids and turn them in the direction of college. I want to focus on one particular thing Kip is doing that Bill didn't mention. And that is, they have come to the realization that the single most important thing kids need to learn is character. They need to learn to respect themselves. They need to learn to respect their schoolmates. They need to learn to respect their teachers. And most important, they need to learn to respect learning. That's the principal objective. If you do that, the rest is just pretty much a coast downhill. And the teachers, the way you teach these things to kids is by having the teachers and all the other staff embody it every minute of every day. Obama appealed to virtue, and I think he was right. And the virtue that we need above all others, I think, is practical wisdom, because it's what allows other virtues, honesty, kindness, courage, and so on, to be displayed at the right time and in the right way. He also appealed to hope. Right again. I think there is reason for hope. I think people want to be allowed to be virtuous, to do the right thing the right way for the right reasons. This kind of wisdom is within the grasp of each and every one of us if only we start paying attention. Paying attention to what we do, to how we do it, and perhaps most importantly, to the structure of the organizations within which we work, so as to make sure that it enables us and other people to develop wisdom rather than having it suppressed. Thank you very much.
Cheat horse is good and unfriendly to strangers. I ride and you run in, makes my guns talk the best. But the rangers and deputies are hired by the rich man to catch me and hang me, my shiny black.
The media used to make this episode are available online at www.unwelcomeguest.net/506. I would welcome more questions to ask Lynn Gerry either via email. My address is unwelcome@altruists.org, or using the show's mailing list at www.altruists.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can.